This week's parasha, Parshas Vayechi, we're going to start with an interesting thing. I mean, this, truthfully, the parasha is full of brachas, so I want to discuss a little bit how exactly a bracha works, because when you read the psukim, you'll see something interesting. The pasuk starts off, Yosef brings his children to Yaakov Avinu, and Yaakov at that time is already old, and he couldn't see well. And the pasuk says as follows, here are my children in Perek Mem Ches Pasuk Yud. Please bring them to me and I will bless them. And the pasuk continues and says, "V'enei Yisrael kavdu mizayken," and the eyes of Yisrael, the eyes of Yaakov Avinu, they were heavy from meaning he couldn't see well. Lo yuchal lirayos, he couldn't see. V'yagish oislam elav, he brought them close to him. V'yishaku hem v'yichabek lem, and he kissed them and he hugged them. Now this wasn't his first encounter with Yosef's children, Ephraim and Manasseh. As a matter of fact, Ephraim spent many years learning by him, and before they had already met many times. So why was there a sudden sign of or affection that Yaakov was showing Ephraim and Manasseh before he decided to go give them the brachas, before he decided to bless them? So the Sephorno over here, why don't we show him? He says something very interesting. He says, "Vayishak lohem vayichabek lohem, kidei shetidbak nafshay bohem v'ticha oleim brachasai." Why did he kiss them? Why did he hug them? In order that he could connect and he could attach himself to Ephraim and Manasseh's soul, and through that he could bless them. Meaning, the Sephora is telling us that when you go to a rabbi, when you go to somebody or anybody, the Gemara says you shouldn't take anybody's blessing lightly. When we go and we ask for a blessing, it's not just a... You can't just throw it out there and say, "Oh, you should be blessed," or you know, or "You should be the best." And it's not a magic trick. But what has to happen is the person who's blessing has to attach himself to the person he wants to bless, and their souls have to connect somehow, somewhat, and through that he could give a blessing. So the Sforno is saying is that normally, when you come for a blessing, I can look at you, and through seeing, we'll explain soon more in detail. So that would be the typical way to connect with somebody. Here, Yaakov Avinu couldn't see well, therefore he had to attach himself in a different form. And how did he do that? So the Sforno says he did that by kissing his grandchildren and hugging them. Now it's an interesting thing, because simply we look at seeing as just a way of getting around, or it's part of our life. But here we see that there's something much deeper to seeing, more than just a way of recognizing things. Because we see that the Sephora seems to say that normally, and under normal circumstances, if Yaakov could have seen, that's all he would have needed to do is look at his grandchildren and gaze upon them, and through that he would have connected to himself. I don't know what the source is, but they say that the eyes are the window to the soul. I'm sure you've heard it before. I don't know if there's any real source to it, but that means because through the eyes one can see. And that's why the pasuk continues, and the pasuk later on says that Yaakov Avinu gave a bracha. He blessed Yosef, and pasuk tezvav says vayivarech Yosef, and he blessed Yosef, and he gave him his blessing. Over there, we don't see any sort of hugging and kissing. So they explain is because over there Yosef was Yaakov's apple of his eye. So they already had that connection. And therefore he needed to do nothing more, and therefore he didn't need that to connect, because they were already connected. But his grandchildren, he didn't know as well, so in place of looking at him, he had to kiss them and hug them. Now, there's interesting, we see this concept even more. First of all, you see this idea also by cursing, by Balak. When Balak and Bilam went to curse, so what happened over there? So the psukim over there is that the pasuk says over there that Bilam and Balak they went to a high place, and the pasuk says in order they looked over Klal Yisrael, they looked to see the whole Jewish nation, and then they try to curse Klal Yisrael. So the Ramban over there says, if I can find it quickly, They set up a mizbeach to make sacrifices, and then the pasuk says, "Vayalehu b'omid ba'al v'yam misham k'tzei am." And they saw part of the nation. Says the Ramban, "Hayamala osam b'makim shirenu." They went up to a higher place, in a place where they could see Klai Yisrael, they could see the Jewish nation. in order they could put the intention of the curse, but he parted not in order that their souls shouldn't separate from the nefesh of Klal Yisrael. So you see that you see two things. You see, first of all, when one's cursing, also a curse has to also be a very it's deeper than just words. And also you see is that the way to create this connection is through seeing. You want to add something?
No, it's way
different. Oh, okay. and we see there's a halacha in Shulchan Aruch says that a person is not allowed to be mistakel in the face of a rasha. And it's interesting because the halacha also is that if somebody sees a handsome guy, the Shulchan Aruch passes, you should make a bracha on him because it's God's creation and you should make a blessing on it. So the Mefarshim asked on the Shulchan Aruch, how does that work? We just said you can't look at the face of a wicked person, so then how could you just make a blessing on a guy? I guess we're assuming that this guy is a wicked person. So Mefarshim explains because it's okay to look at somebody. So there are two ways of looking, at gazing. You could look and then you could stare. You could gaze and you could just glance and you could really look. So histakel usually means when you're not just see, but you're actually looking and you're paying attention. So it's okay to look at a guy, and when you see a guy and he's a handsome person, you can make a bracha. But if he's a rasha, then one should not stare at him.
Why is it that he says one assumes that a guy is a wicked person if he follows the Noahic laws?
I'm not sure myself. I think if he does follow the seven mitzvahs, then he's okay. But I guess from the fact that the halacha puts it down simply that any good you make a bracha on, it seems like we wouldn't differentiate, right? Also, we see this difference between steering and looking by the Gemara said one should not. Also, the Gemara used the term of histakel to look at a catch at a rainbow. At the same time, when you see a rainbow, you're supposed to make a bracha. So how do we work those two things out? So the one God says over there is, of course, one could look at it, but one shouldn't gaze at it. He shouldn't stare at it. He shouldn't intentionally look at it too much. So it's interesting. But we see over here that there's a certain power that looking at something has on a person. And Rabbi Yonah and Shai Chuvah, when he goes through different ideas of what causes a person to keep away from being good. So he discusses many things about staying away from a bad person and not trying to flatter him, not trying to look up to him because he's wealthy or because he's famous. And then he says that there's a Mishnah that says, "Al tischab b'nei Rasha." One should not connect himself to a Rasha. Simply that means is that you shouldn't hang out with them. You shouldn't invite him for meals. You shouldn't spend your Sundays just hanging out with him. But the Rabbanian he adds over here and he says that also. Then he says that by Yitzchak Avinu, he was blind at the end of his life. And the Gemara says, why was he blind? The Gemara says a fascinating thing. The Gemara says because Yitzchak, all his life, Yitzchak thought that Esav was a good person. And not because he turned a blind eye, because Esav did a very fine job in fooling his father. So Yitzchak had no idea that Esav was a Rasha. I'm sure he respected Esav even more than Yaakov Avinu. See, obviously he spent many times looking at him and being mischaber with him. And therefore the Gemara says, since Yitzchak was mistakel b'fnei Rasha, since Yitzchak steered in the face of a Rasha, meaning since Yitzchak steered the face of Esav, therefore caused him to become blind in his old age. So Rabbi Yonah says, when he's going through this idea of connecting oneself and attaching oneself to a Russia, he says, therefore, one should not look at the face of a Russia. And he brings the story of Yitzchak, because he looked at the face of Esav, therefore he became blind. So we see clearly from Rabbeinu Yonah also this idea that looking at something is not just it's not just as simple as it seems, but it's actually creating something within our minds, and it's creating a attachment to what we're looking at. So if it's something good, then obviously it would create a positive within us. But if it's something bad, it creates something negative. But not just creating something negative, also it attaches us to what we're staring at. There's a story. I don't remember the names, and I can't confirm it. But it's going back a few hundred years. There was somebody who was murdered, and they couldn't find the murderer. And the rabbi of the city said, "Go to this dead man's body, and open his eyes and look in his eyes, and see, and you may be able to see the image of the murder." And the story goes, they opened his eyes, and they saw a image like a, I guess, however would look in one's pupil of his murderer. And the way they explain it is because that was obviously this murder came to kill him, and it created a tremendous effect in him. And that image was still in him. I don't know if the story is true, but the idea for sure is true. That when one looks at something, when one stares at something, it creates this, it definitely creates. First of all, it's a way of connecting to somebody, and if you're connecting to somebody, therefore it creates either negative or positive vibes. So that's why the Sephorno over here says, going back to our Pasha, after the Sephorno over here says that one should be very careful. That's why Yaakov, in order to give his blessing, because we say in order to bless somebody, you have to connect to that person. So either a simple way would be to look at him. So if you can't look at him, he had to hug him and kiss him. Okay. Now the pasuk over here continues, and the pasuk says, when Yaakov went to give, it wasn't all blessings, but he gave each of his children. He explained to them who they were and what they were. Sometimes there was blessing, sometimes there was rebuke. So with Reuben, he started off with a bit of rebuke, and he says, and because we all know the story of Reuben when he switched his mother's bed when Yaakov was supposed to be with Rachel that night, and he switched it with Leah. He acted too quickly, so Yaakov waited now to rebuke him. And Rashi in Parshas Devarim, Rashi says in the beginning of Devarim that Moshe also, when he wanted to rebuke the Jewish nation, he waited until he was about to die. And Rashi says, and how did Moshe Rabbeinu know to wait to rebuke Klal Yisrael, to wait to rebuke the Jewish nation? How did he know to wait so long? So Rashi says he learned that from Yaakov. Why? Because Yaakov, we see also, when he wanted to rebuke Reuben for what he did wrong, he didn't do it right away. He didn't do it 10 years later. He waited until he was on his deathbed, and then he said, "Reuben, by the way, your action that you did was wrong." Now Rashi continues, and he says a tremendous thing. He says, "Now why did Yaakov wait so long in order to give him Musa, in order to tell him off? I mean, we're not talking about a bad person. Reuben, the Gemara says, he spent all his life fasting because he knew he sinned, and even that sin wasn't a sin that me and you can understand. It was a sin according to his spiritual level. It was considered a sin. And the Gemara says even more so. The Gemara says somebody who says that Reuben sinned, he's making a mistake. So that means Reuben did something wrong. It was extremely, it was only wrong because of his spiritual level, a very fine thing." And Rashi says, anyway, and Rashi, even knowing all this, Rashi still says that Yaakov even waited until he was about to die because he was scared that if he would tell him off earlier, Reuben might go and attach himself to Esav. He might leave the Shvatan, he might leave Yaakov Avinu, and he might attach himself to Esav, which is a mind-boggling idea. How could that be? What's that supposed to mean? How could Yaakov Avinu have really been nervous that Reuben is going to go now and he's going to, because of, I mean, Yaakov Avinu didn't even when Yaakov Avinu told him off, he didn't say that you're a bad person. He didn't say you did something wrong. He just said that your action that you did was wrong. And Reuben himself, all his life he spent doing tshuva on this action, and he fasted for whatever he did wrong. And even when he did wrong with such a small thing, that Gemara says if you call him a sinner, then you're making a mistake. So what was Yaakov Avinu's fear that by telling him off he's going to attach himself to Esav? We're talking about the leaders of, I'm saying, not our forefathers, but we're talking about the Shvatim of Yaakov Avinu. These people were head and shoulders above what we could imagine. So as follows. So Rav Chaim Shlomitz explains as follows, and I'll explain it first, and then I'll explain to you where he I'll bring it out from different psukim. That when you come to somebody and you want to tell them off, so there's a specific mitzvah in the Torah of telling someone off, but it obviously has to be done in a very specific way, and has to be done in a very intelligent way with a lot of thought and a lot of sensitivity. But like the pasuk clearly says, when you go tell someone off, make sure you don't embarrass them. Meaning, although this person did sin, and maybe did it on purpose, we still have to be careful the way it's done. And Chaim Shlomitz explains that when you tell someone off, you're not coming to tell them that you did this wrong. When someone did something wrong, obviously he's making a mistake. That his assumptions of the way he should be leading his life was one way. You have to explain to him that you did this wrong because you're making a mistake. Your whole premise for living a life like this is wrong. Your assumption for doing this action is because you thought that one should act like this, or one should be like that, is wrong. So a little bit, what you're doing over here is you're undermining who he is. Because everybody has their way of living. Everybody likes to think what they're doing is right, somewhat, somehow. And you're coming now, and you're telling him that you're wrong. So you're basically, whatever he's standing on, you're opening up from with under. So, and he explains, you see this, you see the severity of this. You see this from the Chumash. The pasuk earlier says by when Yosef came and revealed himself to the Shvatim. So the pasuk says, "Ani Yosef, ha'ed v'chai. I'm your son Yosef. Is your father still alive?" So the Gemara says that over there, what happened? The pasuk says the brothers, because they became so embarrassed, they couldn't live with themselves. They all kind of shrank to the corner, and they tried to bury themselves alive. So the Gemara says that if the Shvatim were embarrassed of Yosef, their own brother, because of their action, because they sold him, of course, how embarrassed are we going to be in the day of God's judgment? And there's different ways of explaining this, but he explains that what's the correlation between Yosef telling his brothers that I'm your brother, and God judging us on the day of judgment? He says as follows. He says that what happened? He says that the brothers, for whatever reason, without getting involved in all the details and what their mistake was, but they didn't like Yosef, and they wanted rid of him. And they knew Yosef had dreams, and when he'll be a leader, and when they were all going to have to bow down to him. What did they do to avoid this? First they wanted to kill him, and then they decided, no, we're not going to kill him, instead we're going to sell him. And, right? And they threw him into the bar, and ended up selling him, and they went to Mitzrayim. So when they went home that day, they assumed that everything was fine. Life is good. We took care of a problem, whatever that problem was. Obviously, it wasn't just a simple jealousy, but whatever the problem was, Yosef couldn't think that he was our leader. Yosef thought we were going to bow down to him. We're not going to bow down to him. Now, look, we sold him to the Arabs. He went down to Egypt. Nothing will ever come of him. And possibly even maybe he was dead. So now, what happened all of a sudden? They're living a life, based on this premise. They're assuming that Yosef was dead, and their problem was taken care of. And Yosef gets up and he says, "I need Yosef. I'm your brother Yosef." So everything just crumbled from within. And that's why they just, that was a sudden shock that they had. Because for all these years, for these tens of years where Yosef was gone, they assumed they took it, they eliminated the problem, and now they realize that not only did they not eliminate the problem, but through what they did, it brought their so-called problem back. And so this is also the idea of techacha. Meaning we all live life, and we all try to do good, but we all make mistakes. So until we're ready to listen to our rabbis, or to our mentors, or to our parents, or to our friends who could make a better judgment than we could from within, so we're going to live a certain assumption, and we're going to do things based on certain premises that we think is correct. Now in this world it's a world of darkness, and nothing is ever perfectly clear. But it's going to come a day when God's going to show us clearly that what we've been doing, when we thought that by me going and doing this, I'm doing the right thing, God's going to say that everything you've been doing, which you thought was the righteous thing, you were wrong about.
Everything?
Well, I don't mean everything, but there are things which we were doing, which we could have been wrong about. And obviously, now, if we were wrong because we didn't know better, I'm saying God's judgment is fair. And it's accurate, but the point is because sometimes sometimes we only think like that because either we want to think like that, or because maybe we didn't know better, but we didn't even want to listen. Some people are more than blessed, but everybody in their own lives, even the greatest rabbis in their own level are doing things in their own lives, maybe smaller than me and you, but they're doing things which they're assuming is the correct thing. And really, one day they'll find out that it was incorrect. And we see this similar also by, we see this a similar idea also by Yitzchak and by Esav. What happened when Yitzchak told Esav, "Go out, bring me food, I'm going to bless you." What happened? Yaakov came, he took the brachas, Esav came in, and the pasuk says, "V'yechad chorad gedola," and suddenly he started shaking, he started shivering, he had a tremendous fear. What was the fear? So there are different explanations, but according to our understanding of what rebuke really means, and why a person is gonna, and why the Shvatim were all suddenly felt embarrassed and they felt shameful in front of Yosef. So this tremendous charada, this tremendous fear that Yitzchak suddenly has, because the pasuk says, Rashi brings it down, the Medrash says, I'm sorry, that when Esav walked in, he smelled the smell of Gehenna. So what did we say before? Yitzchak became blind. Why? Because he assumed that Esav was a righteous person, and therefore he looked at him, and that caused him to go blind. So his whole life he was putting he knew Yaakov was a special person, but he was saying, Yaakov, you're second class. Yitzchak, Esav is a bachar, Esav is a special person, he's a righteous person, he might even be the one who's going to take over my dynasty, or he'll be my heir, and I'm giving him the blessings. And also at the end of his life, Esav walks in, he smells the smell of Gehenna, and Yaakov realizes, oh my goodness, so my whole entire life I've been living under the assumption that Esav is a good person, and I've been feeding him everything good, and I've been assuming he's going to be the one who's going to take me over, and now I realize everything was wrong. That's the charada gadol that Yitzchak had. That was a tremendous fear that Yitzchak had. So here also, so and that's really what all rebuke is, because when someone does something wrong, you say, by the way, let's say you walk on the street and someone desecrates Shabbos, you just say, by the way, you're a terrible person, you desecrate Shabbos. It's not proper rebuke. You have to explain to them. You have to realize that today is what Shabbos is, what God is, and so really what you're doing is, it's a very delicate situation, because you're basically stripping this person from whoever we are, what we think. And he obviously thought something all his life. So when you're coming and you come to tell someone off, and when you're rebuking somebody, it's a very delicate and it's a very scary thing, because this person could suddenly just he loses. We are what we think, and if you tell me everything I'm going to think all my life is wrong, then you're nobody. You're nowhere to turn anymore. So obviously it's on bigger or smaller levels, depending on what the rebuke is. But ultimately what you're doing is in some form or fashion, you're undermining and telling this person you're not who you think you are, what you think you are is wrong. So now that is a cause of charada gadol. That is a cause of a tremble which Yitzchak had, and that was Yaakov's fear, that even though Reuben knew that he sinned, when you come to rebuke somebody, what you're doing is telling him that in some sense, Reuben, you're making a mistake in who you are. You're making mistakes, and you're making a mistake not what you did so much, but what you thought. And when a person loses his identity, then he has to turn for something else. And Yaakov was scared he might turn to Esav.
Why did it change at the time when he finally rebuked him? Reuben could still come berserk and sell something.
So it's a good question. I mean that question is a good question regardless. Meaning, how are you going to explain the idea why Yaakov waited, but why did it help him to wait before his death? But it could be because when I know you, so I know you well, and you think that I look at you in a certain way, and I trust you and I respect you. Now when I come and say, by the way, I don't know your name, what's your name?
Boris.
Mr. Boris, I totally think you're wrong about the way you deal with your clients. Now you just realized that all your life you thought I respected you that much, and now you just went down seven notches in my eyes. So that's a cause of tremendous, not fear, but it's an upheaval in your life, because somebody who you thought trusted you and liked you and respected you, you just lost that. So now every time you're going to see me, you're going to feel uncomfortable, because you thought our relationship was like this, and now really it's like this. So it could be that when Yaakov said, I'm not going to do it while I'm still alive, Reuben has to live with me every day, because it'll be too much for him. Because he thought, I respect him this much, and now he's really mistaken. Therefore, I'm going to wait until right before I'm about to die, therefore he won't have to look at me in the eye again every time he thinks about this. And he'll deal with it, hopefully. And hopefully he'll deal with it in the right way, and he'll repent, and he'll fix his ways, and he'll change who he is. But he shouldn't have to look at me again and feel those uncomfortable feelings again.
So how did you start the story with Joseph? So how did Joseph solve this problem?
How did Yaakov solve this
problem? Well, I just want to talk about Joseph, and Joseph told his brothers.
Joseph wasn't looking to solve the problem, but we just point that the Gemara is pointing out. You see from Yosef that even though he was just caught, that by telling him I'm your brother Yosef, which he had to tell him anyway, that caused a tremendous upheaval in their life. Or it caused them they lost their bearings for a moment. So why did they lose their bearings? Because something that they assumed is suddenly just pulled on the carpet from under them. So back to over here. So therefore, Yaakov wanted to wait until the end of his life, until he came and he said anything to Reuven. Now, we see a similar idea by the pasuk speaks about by the Mecharis. In the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, there was somebody who was, the Gemara says that he walked outside. He walked out and he blessed Hashem, meaning he cursed. So the question is, what suddenly happened? So the Gemara said, you know what happened? I don't remember the details, but he thought he was part of one Shevet. And he pitched a tent as part of that Shevet. And in reality, that on that Shevet said, no, you don't belong with our Shevet because you follow the mystery. Therefore you had no right to be with us because the lineage goes after the father and after the mother. And they went to Bezin and said, no, let's go to court. Let's figure this out. They went to Moshe Rabbeinu and he said, I think I belong here because my mother's from Shevet Shimon, whatever it was. And Shevet Shimon is telling me, nope, sorry, you can't be. You don't belong here because your father's not from Shevet Shimon. Your father's an Egyptian. And Moshe Rabbeinu said, you don't belong here. And therefore he went out and he cursed. You know, he lost the court case. So why did that cause him to curse? So Chaim Shlomo explains is because every person needs... It's a similar concept. Every person has a sense of identity from a family. You're part of a community. You're part of a shul. You're part of something. And he thought that he belonged somewhere. He belonged in Shevet Shimon. He belonged here. He belonged there. And he can't. When he walked out of court, Moshe Ben basically told him, "You don't belong. You don't belong where you thought you belonged. You don't belong there." So he lost a sense of being. Because he lost a sense of being. Of course, he totally lost himself. And he explains that when a person finds himself in a situation of sudden confusion, for lack of a better word, so that's a tremendous opportunity for the Tzahara to come and try to grab onto a person. Because when a person feels good about himself and he's doing well, so when he knows something is wrong, he'll be able to stand up against it. But they saw it because in his he knows the nature of a person and knows when a person loses himself and he feels he just has some upheaval in his life, whatever it may be, that so he knows that's a good opportunity to try to get him. And therefore they took the opportunity when he walked out of the court and he said, "You believe in God? What for? There is no God." And he said, "You know what, you're right. I don't belong anywhere. I'm a nobody. I just lost my whole identity," and that caused him to go and do the worst of the worst. And we see this concept also. Not everybody explains it like this, but one can explain this idea also by the golden calf. How did that happen? They just gotten the Torah. They've seen the greatest miracles. How can we understand that they practically saw God? How could they have gone from being on top of the world, from seeing having the greatest revelations of God, to going and sinning with the golden calf? How does a person go from such great height to fall so low, so quickly? It wasn't like they sinned something small or they made a small mistake. They bought the golden calf, which could be a form of idol worship. So the Medrash says, that what happened? Moshe Rabbeinu went up to Shemayim, and he said, "I'm coming back down in 40 days." And then now they miscalculated. And they expect the Moshe Rabbeinu down. And we have to realize that these people, a few months ago, they were slaves. They were slaves to the most. I mean, if we think like any of these communist nations are controlling. You think North Korea is controlling? I mean, in Egypt, I think the Gemara says that there was never a slave who ever escaped. So they were in total control by the Mitzrayim. All of a sudden, literally a Mashiach, right? A Savior comes and takes them out and tells them, "I'm going to bring you to a land. It's going to be your own land. You're going to become wealthy. You're going to become well off. You're going to do well." And he gave them the Torah. He was their physical and spiritual leader. He gave them the food. All they needed to take care of. Also, all of a sudden, this person is missing from their life. and they had a calculation. They knew Moshe wasn't going to lie to them. And the leader says, I'll be back in 40 days. It came 40 days, or they thought it was 40 days, and Moshe Rabbeinu was not around. What happened? So maybe they would have waited. But the Satan knew that this is a good opportunity. He created in the sky, the Midrash says, an image, a cloud maybe, an image of the Aron of Moshe Rabbeinu, meaning as if Moshe Rabbeinu was dead. So they looked up and they saw, wow, our leader is dead. Our life is dead. He was our lifeline. He was our savior. He took us out. He freed us. He's been taking care of us spiritually and physically. And suddenly it was too much for them. So at that opportunity, the Satan came and said, you know what? You need something. You need a replacement for Moshe Rabbeinu. Go make the golden calf. Maybe he'll be able to be your in-between God and between you and God. So he's saying, so it's a similar kind of idea that because of this, when a person it totally loses everything that he knew, in whichever way, whether it's because of someone rebuked him, whether because he just assumed things for whatever reason, or because of the mistake of the golden calf, it's a very dangerous time for a person, and he could, and if there are no, the person is most vulnerable then, and that's the time that he tries to go and get him to do something wrong. And that's why Yaakov was scared that Reuven will do something wrong, because when his father, who was his life, who looked up to, will tell him off and tell him that where he made a mistake might be too much for him. And he might lose himself in that moment. And just in the general idea of when you're coming to do something which one has to do, or rebuking, you see in this week's parasha, a little bit we have to talk about this week's parasha, when Yosef went to bless Ephraim and Manasseh, so what happened? He put Manasseh on the right side and Ephraim on the left side because Manasseh was the older one. Yaakov knew through prophecy that really Yosef, that Ephraim will be the greater one, and therefore the pasuk says, where's the pasuk? Temperek memches pasuk. Pasuk Yudal. It says, "Vishlach Yisos Yimino Yivyoshes Al Rish Ephraim." And Yaakov stuck out his right hand and put it in the hand of Ephraim, which is the younger one. And Smol Yad Rosh Menasha, and he put his left hand on the side of Menasha. Sikas Yodav Kimnasha Bechor. He switched his hands. He just crossed them over because he wanted his right hand to be on Ephraim. Sikol is a funny term to use. So sikol comes from seichel, from intelligence. So simply you could just explain what intelligence was, because he had the foresight to know that Ephraim will be better, and therefore he used his intelligence to switch his hand. But the Chizkuni, he says, why did he do something funny like that? The natural thing would have been just to tell Yosef, switch places. So the Chizkuni says, I think it's a tremendous, powerful lesson. He says, because Yaakov knew that Ephraim would be the greater one, and therefore he had to be on the right side. He had to be on the upper hand of the blessing. But truthfully, Menashe was Bechor. So he had to switch things. But the Chizkuni says, Yaakov even said, the intelligence that he used was, he said that, how can I go and hurt Menashe like that? And just make a whole commotion. So you can't, you go here, and you go here, and you go here, and make a whole commotion. So I have to do this. But let's try to minimize the pain, and let's try to minimize the insult as much as possible. And therefore, although the natural thing would have been was just to switch their hands, he said, to switch them physically, he just switched his hands like that. In order to minimize what had to be done. And I think it's a tremendous lesson, because often, whether as a parent, or even amongst your friends, or even as a boss, with your employees, sometimes you have to do something. But sometimes you think, hey, this person deserves, he did something wrong. Like I'm saying, my kid was chutzpahdik, he deserves to be smacked. I'm going to scream at him. You know, a rabbi thinks, this kid, how could he do such a thing? He could get up in class and call me an idiot? He deserves to be screamed at. And you probably should scream at him. But think before you do it. Does he deserve to be, should you scream at him in public? Should you tell him off in public? Or think, how much does he deserve, and try to minimize as much as possible. So Yaakov knew that Ephraim deserved to be on the right side. But he said, but why should we let's minimize the insult as much as possible. So, I mean, it's not exactly what we were saying, but it's just, you just see again how, you know, like, how, I think, I mean, I'm just telling you from my own personal feeling with that, I think instinctively, I don't know if I would have ever felt like that. You see that the others who were, I'm saying, we are from them, is, you know, everything was sorted out. They say a story with Rav Chaim Kanievsky. You ever heard of him? He's in Bnei Brak. He's from the arguably one of the biggest rabbis we have today, alive. He had some sort of stroke, or he had some sort of procedure done. And after the procedure, the doctor asked him to write something down. And he wrote down, I don't remember what he wrote down, maybe he wrote down based on Masal, with Hashem, with God's help, or something like that. And the doctor, he was blown away. He said, I've never seen this before. I've been doing this surgery forever, and this is standard. I make you write something down just to see if your mind's lucid. Because he couldn't talk, like, apparently. He said, I've never seen anybody who didn't write their name down. So, what urged you not to write your name down? This is a natural thing for everybody to do. You have to write, when I ask you, they give you a blank piece of paper with a pen, and say, write something down, you write your name. That's the first thing that comes to mind. He said, because this is right after our surgery. This is when he's trying to see if he was lucid. And he said, you know why? Because the Gemara says, one should never write his name on a blank piece of paper. Because I can take a piece of paper, and I can write that Yaakov Brzezinski owes whoever $2,000, and have his signature on the bottom. So this was natural to him. When he asked to write his name, he said, I'm not going to write my name. We asked to write something down, I'm not going to write my name, because the Gemara said not to. Obviously, it's not what you're going to do. Yeah, okay. I don't know if I got to everything, but another idea over here. Another interesting...
How do you understand that Yitzchak didn't know definitely Yaakov and Esau, that he was fooled. He's a navi. How can he have not perceived all those years that Esau was a Rasha? It seems hard to believe.
Well, it's a good question. I think there are quite a few different ways of explaining what exactly that meant, but first of all, just because one's a navi, doesn't mean he knows everything. mean he doesn't know everything. He only knows what God tells him.
Right.
Now, it's interesting enough, because how did Rivka know that Yaakov deserved the blessings? Because she, when she was pregnant,
right,
she said, what's going on over here? And she went.
Apparently,
she never shared that information with Yitzchak.
Right.
So you see that although there is prophecy, but not necessarily the prophecy sharing with everybody, and I think the Ramban speaks out over there, is because at that time, although there was prophecy, but when there was prophecy, it wasn't given to tell the Jewish nation. There wasn't a Jewish nation. It was, when you got a prophecy, it was meant for you specifically. And therefore, you had no right to go to anybody else. So Rivka, she received a prophecy through shame and through shame and aver, but she was never told that she could tell Yitzchak. Therefore, she kept mum. She never said a word. There are different ways of explaining, but I think the simple explanation would be is that so Esav did a very fine job in fooling Yitzchak. He came in, he asked good questions. He said, "How do I take a tenth off salt, which I'm not obligated to?" And he played a good game.
Right, that's it. You said he smelled Gehinnom.
Right, so
why all of a sudden now, and not his whole life? Why is he? What made him aware at that moment?
It's a good question. It's a good question. It could be on that day he sinned quite a few times.
Mm.
Actually, it wasn't that day. It was later on, it was earlier in his life. I don't know. Maybe, I don't know. I don't know. But it could be this is God's way of telling Yitzchak that. But I don't know. The pasuk when we're discussing all the brachas that Yaakov gave to his children, so by Yehuda it says, "Vayotzer shevet mi Yehuda." Vayotzer shevet mi Yehuda. Rashi says, "What does that mean? That from David and on, there was other kings, not from Shevet Yehuda, but from David and on, the kingdom will belong to Shevet Yehuda." So the Ramban, although it's a little bit after Hanukkah, the Ramban says as follows. The Ramban says that what happened? We all know that Hashmonaim saved the Jewish nation. The Gemara says, without the Hashmonaim, who from many of them were from Shevet Levi, the Kahanim, there wouldn't be any Torah mitzvahs in Klal Yisrael anymore. So they saved us from a spiritual holocaust and from a physical holocaust. And still, the Gemara says that there is no one left from the house of Chashmonaim. Anybody who says he's from the house of Chashmonaim, he's considered a slave because there was no one left from the house of Chashmonaim. So Ramanov here explains, he says, how come the Chashmonaim, who were the savior of the Jewish nation, they were tremendous people, they technically were the leaders of that generation, how come there's no one left from them? Why do they deserve such a terrible punishment? I will call there Matisyo Chashmonoi, all the children of Matisyo, the Chashmonoi, a tzaddik who was a tzaddik, were avru, it didn't pass over, meaning there was nothing left for them. Ela ba'avur, what's the reason for this? Shemolchu v'lehoi mizera Yehuda u'meis David, because they took it upon themselves to be the king of the Jewish nation, and it wasn't as per Yaakov said to Yehuda, but that's the Shevi Yisrael, that the kingdom will, from David on will always be the Shevi Yehuda, and since they had no right doing that, therefore that was their punishment. So I don't know exactly, I can't come and play God and say and explain to you why that's fear. I don't know exactly what the severity of the sin was, but I think something that we could take out of this is as follows: is the Chashmonaim, Yochanan was a claim is from Shevet Levi. The Rambam writes that he goes through the setup. He says Avram passed over everything to Yitzchak. Yitzchak passed it to Yaakov, and he said Yaakov, he passed to all children, but he put Shevet Levi in charge. So he said, Levi, you're going to be the rabbis, and you're going to be the reshivas, you're going to be the rabbim, and you're going to make sure that the Torah saves the Klal Yisrael. So you see, Levi had an extremely prominent position in the Jewish nation, and they were the greatest amid the Chacham. They were the greatest rabbis. And that's why Shevet Levi never had any actual physical. They never had any portion in the land of Israel because they had to stay focused on their learning because they had to be the spiritual leaders and they had to be the rabbis and answer all the questions. But although they were so great, we're not talking about somebody who was in the, let's say, the worst of Shvatim. He was a tremendous tzaddik. Ramban himself writes he was a tremendous tzaddik, and it was from Shevet Levi whose job was to ensure and to teach Klaius and to teach Klaius all the Torah. But apparently and obviously, the Rabban seems to be telling us over here is that although that was their job, but every person has their place and time. Every person has their job. Every person has their tafkid in life. Their purpose in life and what they were put on this world for. And a person has to always realize that you're not meant to be him, and he's not meant to be you. So you shouldn't try to be him because, first of all, simply it's not going to work. Second of all, because Yaakov Avinu, in his infinite wisdom, when he went before his final wish, on his deathbed, his final wish and his final command, he gave every Shevet his flag, meaning he told them exactly who you are, what you're meant to be, what your place is in the Jewish nation. We're all like a puzzle, every individual and every Shevet. And Yaakov said, Yehuda, you're meant to be the king, and Levi, maybe you're meant to teach Torah, but you're not a king. No matter how great you are, Levi, you're not meant to be a king. And a person has to realize that. He has a position in this world, and he has a place in this world, and his place, and he can't be someone else. First of all, he can't be someone else, and second of all, he shouldn't be someone else. It's wrong to try to be someone else.
That is understandable for one person, but we're talking about many generations ahead.
Well, so I'm not sure I understand your question. You want to know why his children deserve to be...
Well, in fact, children, why they... deserve that horrible fate.
It's a whole different discussion, but it's clearly that a child could die because of his father's sins.
Well,
that concept is very clear. Exactly how it works is not. I'm saying it could be its own class on its own. But that concept
works for so many generations, though.
Well, it wasn't so many generations. Meaning, well. I'm understanding it that the generations eventually ended. There were no more children.
No, we say when you got to the Chashmonaim, That was many generations after this baracha was made.
Right.
Yes. Oh.
It still can't be. I mean, it's how many generations?
Well, this, you know, yeah, so this command
years,
is forever.
1,000 years.
As a matter of fact, this commandment of that Yehuda should be the ruler, to be the king, only started generations later. Only started in the times of David, of David the king. Until then, there were other kings. So really, Yaakov was telling, was in his infinite wisdom and with his prophecy, he was explaining to his children what their ultimate purpose and what their position as part of the Jewish people was. And they had to realize that what they were meant to be, who they were, and not who they were not. And I guess it's when you try to be someone else, there's nothing worse than that. So again, I'm not coming to explain exactly how the punishment works, but we clearly see that no matter how great you are who you are, and not what you're not meant to be. And we see also when Yaakov sent Yehuda ahead to go down to Goshen. Why did he send him ahead, Rashi says? Rashi brings in Medrash. Medrash says he sent him ahead in order to open the yeshiva. Although Sheva Levi would teach in the yeshiva, but Yaakov understood that Yehuda had to be the one to open the yeshiva. He had to institute things. And once the yeshiva was established, then maybe already Levi could come in. So every person has his position in life. Every person has his place and, you know, of what he's meant to be. And it's probably also the idea of that's really what Yaakov was giving over to his children over here. He gave him over the begolim, the flags that they had there in the midbar also, and as they traveled through the desert. Each shevet had its position. Each shevet had the flags, and that was based on what Yaakov Avinu gave them. It was passed on from generation to generation. So what was the idea of this? The idea is also the same idea. What was happening over here was that Yaakov was explaining, and he was explaining his children. He was trying to bring up the children properly. He was trying to tell them that you, Reuven, you're meant to be Reuven and not Shimon. And he was explaining to them, each had their own color, each had their own personality, each had their own strong points, own weak points, and each had their all part of a bigger picture, but each had their own specific spot in that picture. And it's important for a person to always realize who he is and where he belongs, and not where he doesn't belong.
Well, so there were, say, 12 tribes, right?
Right.
And each tribe was giving a command of what all their generations are to be.
Right.
Now, we also know that today most of these tribes don't exist. So does it mean that the Jews cannot be any of the N-1 or N-2? I mean,
well,
professions or occupations? Or
no, so, really, ultimately, what I think Yaakov was saying is that in a perfect world, in the time when we have everything perfectly, so then we're obviously lacking in our, if we'd all be doing exactly what we're supposed to be doing, and everything would be in its place, then we wouldn't be still sitting in this terrible exile. So part of being in exile is not just all the pains and all the physical discomforts and hurts. Also, it's mainly because we're lacking a tremendous spirituality. And we're lacking a tremendous completion of who we're meant to be as individuals and as a nation.
Right, so what is the solution when a man thinks about what he is to become?
Well, I mean,
when there is no guidance.
Well, there is, I mean, we don't have the guidance like we had then, it's true, right. and that's part of being in exile, but if we sit down and be honest with ourselves, we can know what our strong points are and what we should be working on and what we shouldn't be doing.
Right.
And also, once we are who we are, we have to always recognize our place and know, okay, although maybe I'm a rabbi, although maybe I'm this, it's not my place to say this, or to do that, or to do this. And that was a mistake of the Chashmonah. And as we spoke before about the Megadeth. So, what happened? Megadeth came in. This person came in and he said he wanted to pitch his tent here, and he said, no, he came to Moshe Rabbeinu, he came to the courts, and Moshe Rabbeinu said, you don't belong anywhere. You don't belong there because you're not part of that Sheva because your father was an Egyptian. It sounds so nitpicky, like why are they being so stubborn for?
Well, what is he?
We're a nation full of love and care.
What is he?
Pardon me?
What is, a goy marries a Jewish woman. What does he become? The offspring is still Jewish.
The children are Jewish. The children
so
are
they
Jewish.
Should be within the nation of Israel.
Yeah,
so
they had it.
What is he?
So I don't know, I don't remember, I don't want to say anything, especially since I'm on camera. But I think that those people didn't really have a specific place within the I mean, ultimately, I think when Mashiach comes, they say that all the neshamas really came from a certain, wherever they came from, will all be part of one nation. But I think at that time, they had no place within the camp. But I'm not sure, so don't quote me on that. Sure. But what, we're a nation full of love and care and kindness. I mean, look, that's. I mean, I think that without our love and compassion for one another, we wouldn't have survived in the terrible exile. So why were they being so stubborn for? Why did just let them live? But I think cause at that point there were, they weren't being nitpicky about a physical or a monetary loss of you taking part of my people are more than happy to welcome guests in and help people who are needy. But the idea was that the setup over there wasn't just random, wasn't just first come first serve. It was done according to what they had passed on from Yaakov Avinu. It was done based on their spiritual needs. And a person had to realize that whoever belonged here or not there. And if you didn't belong here, not just because there's no room for you, it's because in our spiritual work and what we're ultimately here for, there was a very specific order. And where you belong, you belong. Where you didn't belong, you didn't belong. So Moshe Benjamin said that, and the people of Hashem said, we'd love to help you. Maybe we would send you supper every night. But you don't belong here. You can't be here. And it wasn't so much they weren't being petty, they weren't being cheap, but it was more of a spiritual thing.
But why so
it was more
harsh?
Of a spiritual argument.
Why so harsh? That's a harsh rebuke.
Because it wasn't a rebuke. He was just Moshe Rabbeinu was telling him the fact that you had no place in Shevet Shimon. This is not harsh. This is consequences. If you're not Jewish, then you're not Jewish. So if your father wasn't from Shevet Shimon, you don't belong to Shevet Shimon. This is reality. I mean, ultimately, he wanted to know if he had a place in the Jewish nation. Of course, he did, and maybe he, ultimately, in the time of Mashiach, when the world will be perfected, so you know, everybody will have its place, and everything will make sense again. But the idea was that the setup was a spiritual setup, and they weren't just being petty about a piece of real estate. It was because they knew and understood that the setup that they had was to give them their ultimate. It helped them reach the ultimate in what they were here, as a nation, they were here for. And we don't understand it. It seemed just like a physical setup, but it was based upon many spiritual matters. And that's why I had to be like that. That's why I want to end off with one quick story, which I think ties what we said before and after. There's a boy was in yeshiva, in the yeshiva's Mirna as well. It's a big yeshiva. And the yeshiva, Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, he was a tremendous man. A man who knew a great man of Torah. And the way it worked was, in the beginning of the semester, so all the boys were outside, and they tried to work out study partners. And there was one boy who couldn't find a study partner. Now, obviously, I've been through the system myself. It takes time to find someone who wants to study with you. It's a little bit dejecting, because you start thinking, maybe I'm not good enough, maybe no one's learning with me. There's one boy who couldn't find a study partner, but it was for a good reason, saying he hasn't proved himself very well previously. And he came into the yeshiva of Chaim Shmulevitz, and he said, "Rabbi, what should I do? No one wants to learn with me." Chaim Shmulevitz said, "You know what? Go out one more day. It usually lasts for a few days because there's a few hundred boys in the yeshiva. And if you still can't find somebody to learn with you, then I'll learn with you." So the boy walked out with his back straighter. He went back out to look for Harusa, and whoever was in the room with him, he asked him. He said, "Rabbi, what are you thinking? You know that this boy doesn't have a Harusa for a good reason. He's not doing well in yeshiva, and he's not the brightest boy, and he's not diligent enough. That's why he's no one to learn with him. Like, forget about anything else. It's not going to work. Like, you're light years ahead of him." And he told him, he said, "You're right. But I want to explain something, that when somebody feels dejected, and they feel like no one cares about him, no one wants him, it's a matter of life and death. Because like we spoke about this person who cursed God because he felt like he was a nobody. And although I know it's not going to work, but it's important for him to know that there's somebody dear for him and somebody cares about him. Because if he feels like he's a nobody, then it's really a matter of life or death. And that could be the end of his spirituality. And therefore, although I knew it makes no sense, and although I knew it's not going to work, so it's important that he felt like there's somebody who's going to be there for him. So even if he doesn't find somebody to learn with, he won't give up. And he won't God forbid, give up all his Judaism." Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.